Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. I'm clinical psychologist Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host Dr. Reed Robison and I have a friendly conversation about how to leverage healthy sleep, nutrition, and exercise habits for better mental health. This is a topic that Reed and I love to nerd out on. This is the kind of stuff we talk about when we don't have to talk about other stuff. So I really hope you enjoy listening to the conversation as much as we did having it. By the way, if you want to contact us about the show, email us at psychfrontiers@novamind.ca. You can also find us on Instagram at Dr. Steve Thayer, at Innerspace Doctor, and at Novamind. Okay, let's get into it. Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, everybody. As usual, joined by my co-host and pal, Reed Robison.
Hey, Steve.
How's it going, Reed?
Excellent.
Good. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad to be with you today to talk about physical fitness and mental health. Reed and I just, you know, if we want to peek behind the scenes, guys, and folks who listen, Reed and I are both avid wellness humans. We have done a lot of personal research and learning around wellness generally, not just mental wellness. I mean, we're both mental health professionals, but we talk a lot offline about the relationship between our physical health and our mental health. So we thought it might be fun just to kind of riff on the things that we've experienced personally and know professionally can really contribute to mental health via the pathway of physical health.
Yeah, it's about time we hit this topic because this truly is bottom of the pyramid stuff. Mm-hmm. Like the foundational ingredients for optimizing all the other parts in life, it seems.
Yeah.
Like the way we move, what we take into our bodies, our habits on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a reason when you go to the doctor, they often ask you, how are you eating? Are you exercising? How are you sleeping? Those three, you know, seem to be, like you say, definite bottom of the pyramid foundational type things. Do you eat smart? Do you move a lot? And do you sleep well?
Yeah, I've had a number of clients sitting here in a conversation like this about, you know, what life is like. And they may be in a deep treatment-resistant depressed episode. And I remember one who was working night shifts, and that was really difficult for them. Mm-hmm. It was a chronic thing, at least on weekdays, and they didn't know what to do with the weekends, and their sleep was so thrown off, and it had a clear, huge impact on their mood, but they couldn't bring themselves to make the leap from, you know, practically or otherwise, leap from working nights to days, and, you know, it kept them stuck, so stuck.
Yeah. Why don't we dive in on sleep for a second? Sleep is huge for your physical and mental health. And there are people who are smarter than us about sleep who have kind of made a career and a living lately about talking about sleep. You got Matthew Walker, who wrote, was it Why We Sleep? Is that the name of his book?
I think so.
And you've got people like Andrew Huberman talking about the importance of sleep and how to make sure your circadian rhythms are on point. And I remember when I was in the Air Force, we had a lot of people present with depressive symptoms. And I had a psychiatrist colleague who sent them all in for sleep studies to see if they had sleep apnea. And a lot of the ones that did, who then got their apnea treated, resolved almost all of their depression symptoms. Yeah. I mean, who knew, right, when you're suffocating every night that it might actually affect your brain? You're hypoxic every night, it might affect your mental health.
But who knew they were actually suffocating,
right?
It's often outside of awareness.
And a lot of these folks didn't fit your typical prototype for sleep apnea. You know, they weren't necessarily overweight. They didn't necessarily have the thick neck. And I've learned quite a bit about sleep apnea since then. And sometimes it can just be the flesh in the back of your throat. Sometimes it can be positional. It can be recessed jaw. There's that book by James Nestor, Breathe, that talks about breath. Breathe.
I like that one.
That talks about how our face shape, human face shape, has narrowed and retreated because we don't eat foods that are hard to chew anymore. And the idea that we have to extract permanent teeth in just about everybody and have orthodontia is a modern problem, not an ancient one.
Yeah, and looking at it personally, I've never had a sleep study.
Yeah.
And so I don't know for certain You know, if I'm having apneic spells in the middle of the night, sure, I do track sleep in other ways. The Oura Ring, which you're wearing one.
This,
right?
I wish I did. This is actually a $5 silicone wedding band.
Okay, that's your wedding ring.
Yeah. Yeah, I love, they actually just came out with version 3 of the Oura Ring. Mm-hmm. I've been looking at that one for a while. I've tried Fitbits. I've tried the Whoop Strap. I have a Garmin watch that's not a great sleep tracker. It's a great adventure tracker. But
you know, my Oura Ring isn't working at the moment. Mm. I should put in a little plug. Fix my Oura Ring to the people of Oura.
Get a new one. Get a version 3.
Yeah, true. But I've discovered that the Apple Watch, if you can get past that thought of I'm not wearing my watch while I sleep, it does really well at tracking sleep. Or even your phone laid on a bed. I know there's something else to be said about having your phone too close at night when you're trying to sleep, but there are these apps that will use the movement of the mattress with a phone laying on it to detect phases of sleep.
Yeah, and I think it's they're good general pictures about how your sleep, the quality of your sleep might be. None of these things are as effective as what they, you know, the electrodes attached to your brain that actually track your sleep studies. There's another guy on YouTube. I've shown him to you before, Reed, and I can't remember his name. I'll put it in the show notes. He's a scientist who will review all these tracking devices, and he actually has like a home EEG that he puts on his head, and just to see how accurate they are. And the ones that just track movement, the actigraphers, they're okay, but the ones like the Oura Ring that not only track movement but temperature and heart rate variability, they give you a little bit more bang for your buck, a little bit more data. And now they have entire mattresses that will do this for you. I think it's is it 8 Sleep? That might be one that tracks that the mattress itself will track your movement. This is all the stuff you hear like sponsoring other podcasts. Yeah. We have no sponsors. This is just stuff we like.
Yeah, but you're right that these aren't a substitute for a sleep study. And these days, you can do a sleep study at home. Mm-hmm. There are groups like Novasom, for example, where as prescribers, we can order it, have it sent to someone's home, covered by insurance to whatever degree someone is covered and their plan will allow it. And then they have you send it back and you get a full-on report to your provider that way.
Yeah. Folks, if you have sleep apnea or you suspect you have sleep apnea, if you have a bed partner that has told you you snore or stop breathing, if you wake up with headaches, like, get it checked. If you can get it treated, and there's lots of ways to treat it, not just a CPAP machine. You can get a dental appliance that'll advance your lower jaw a little bit forward to open up your airway. There's surgical procedures. It can change your life.
So that's, I'm glad we're starting with sleep because it is the one thing, one key question to address early in the process of looking at overall mental health and physical health and wellness. And sleep apnea as a possibility is just one component. There's so many environmental factors, behavioral factors, mental health conditions playing into this, stress, anxiety, routines. I'm wondering, well, and we've trained our colleagues many times in some behavioral and therapeutic strategies in sleep like CBTI and other approaches in addition to just the proper appropriate use of meds when needed. But but I'm wondering, what are your favorite tips for sleep?
Yeah, so routine is everything when it comes to sleep. Getting some light exposure early in the morning. Huberman, I heard him talk about this because he's a, you know, one of the things he's an expert on is the eye.
Yeah.
And he'll say, you know, you need to get outside and not through a window. You need to actually get direct sunlight, you know, through the top of your eye because it hits these particular cells and receptors in your eye that are angled such a way to get the morning sun to start your clock correctly. So the more consistent wake and sleep time you have, the better your mind is going to be like, oh, it's time to go to bed. And then there's some standard sleep hygiene things like use the bed for sleep and sex only. Don't scroll TikTok on your phone. While you're in bed, you know. If you can, I know some people will use a television to kind of lull them to sleep. But if you can go without that, I think that's probably better. Mm-hmm. There are these great apps now that will play white noise or music, or there's something called Sleep Stories that's on like Spotify and the Calm app where you have people with nice voices tell relatively boring stories that you can fall asleep to. But yeah, I will sometimes take magnesium. Magnesium's, is it cypionate?
Threonate.
Glycinate. So threonate and glycinate are the two. I've tried threonate. I know Huberman recommended that. It didn't work for me, but glycinate is the one that helps me sleep better.
Because citrate is for moving your bowels.
Yeah, I made that mistake.
and malate is for more muscle recovery because those cross the blood-brain barrier less than like the threonate glycinate to help with sleep.
Right. CBD sometimes can help. I try to avoid hypnotics. I know that the sedative hypnotics have their role for sure, but if I can't get it with melatonin, magnesium, or CBD, then I try not to use a substance.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's worth exhausting all those things, putting in the work to find the behavioral interventions, because sleeping pills, while needed in some situations and extremely helpful for serious sleep disorders, aren't giving you the same kind of restful sleep as a general rule.
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand that, right? That you take an Ambien, or if even you drink some wine in the evening, it might sedate you. It might slow your thoughts down enough that you can fall asleep. But it interferes with what we call sleep architecture, right? The passage of your brain waves through those states that are really important for cleaning up the shit that you accumulate throughout the day. So you can be conked out, but wake up not well rested on those medicines. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not sleep shaming anybody here.
Yeah.
If you need that stuff to sleep, I'm glad we have it. I went through an Ambien phase in my life, and I'm glad I had it for that phase. But
you know, I was one who was never really able to sleep on airplanes overnight. Mm. Like, I remember interviewing for psychiatry residency at a Columbia program in New York City, flying out from Utah. And I took a red eye and went right to my interview. And I was in this famous psychoanalyst's office sitting there. And I had slept, I don't know, maybe a power nap on the subway, snoring on my way to the medical center. And I was sitting there trying so hard, but not succeeding at nodding off. And then I was meeting with, I think, next Kelly Posner, who wrote the Columbia Suicide Scale for an interview, and just trying to stay awake. After that, the next trip I went on, it was a red eye to Paris. Once Salt Lake got that flight, I got my primary care provider at the time to give me a couple Lunestas to try, like an Ambien alternative. And it was beautiful for my sleep, like a low dose. And I wake up, I'm like, this is amazing, except when I get to Paris, a place I quite love, and I go to get this chocolate croissant that I've been waiting for so long, I had this metallic taste in my mouth that ruined the croissant after that 8-hour trek.
Yeah. So not worth it.
Yeah, it's debatable, but
depending, right?
And not everyone gets that metallic taste. And there are some strategies like orange juice or whatever that some people find helpful.
Yeah, I too have struggled with sleep at strategic, you know, points in my life. In fact, when I was in my residency in the Air Force, I was given the nickname by my cohort friends, WASO, for wake after sleep onset. One of the things we track when we're assessing sleep, because I was constantly falling asleep in meetings. Mm-hmm. In fact, when I matched with this particular site in San Antonio, the program director, the clinical director, I remember when I first got to the location, she's like, oh, you match with us? Well, that's cool. We like you. I do remember you being very sleepy. Like, that was one of the first things she said. And then later, one of my supervisors said, you should just get a sleep study. Like, you look tired all the time. Just go get it figured out. And so I actually do have mild sleep apnea, diagnosed with sleep apnea. But
yeah, that's interesting about the reputation that followed you.
Yeah.
Because it is hard to mask. I've noticed, I remember there was a clinician interviewing for a job with us quite a while ago, but who was never seen without a big Red Bull in their hand.
Yeah.
And I remember how shaky they were, like when going to shake your hand or taking notes. Because I think in my kind of best guess, it's just like sleep deprived and trying to cover it up with a stimulant or stimulants can feel pretty jittery.
Yeah. I've been there. Times when my sleep isn't good and I'm trying to compensate with energy drinks and caffeine, it doesn't feel good. Like you're jittery, you're on edge. It's much better if you can sleep well.
Yeah, there's a sweet spot, whether you're talking about caffeine, like mm-hmm. you go above a certain dose, feels like you're crawling out of your skin or just right. shaky. Same thing with when people are on stimulants for, say, ADHD or even Provigil, Nuvigil for sleep, wake, or shift disorder,
right.
Circadian rhythm disorders. If you go too high, that can feel like a, you know, a whole other kind of difficult trip because you're yeah. almost crawling out of your skin, jittery. Too high of a dose of Adderall, people could start being hyperkinetic or fidgety movement. We see that with meth users.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, you get a little cracked out feeling.
Yeah.
And with caffeine, you get into sort of this vicious cycle where you're drinking a lot of caffeine to compensate, and then depending on how your body metabolizes caffeine, it might still be on board when you're trying to go to sleep, which mm-hmm. exacerbates your insomnia, which, you know, just sort of perpetuates this caffeine use.
Yeah.
So you might have to go on a caffeine holiday, folks, if you want better sleep. And it's rough. You'll go through some withdrawals, but it's worth it in the long run.
Yeah, I think some of that advice also applies to dopamine, the mm. endogenous dopamine, the external sources we get it from, and how it's worth being conscious of what we take into our system, how often, and how reliant we are on them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our fixes to those feel-good dopamine spikes.
Yeah, there's this concept of the dopamine holiday, you know, that you can resensitize yourself to the things that bring you joy by mm-hmm. spending some time away from them. By, you know, the sort of work first, play later. We have these aphorisms in our language because, you know, I think we understood this concept as a society before yeah. we understood the science behind it, that you don't eat your dessert first because it makes the rest of the meal seem uninteresting or unpalatable. You know, too much of a good thing is a phrase that we have.
It's true.
Yeah.
Like this dopamine, some would call the currency of your kind of pleasure and success or motivation. And it depends, like you take something that spikes your dopamine way up there, everyone's going to feel that drive or motivation from it. But, and you have very low dopamine, everyone's going to feel that sluggishness, including when you're withdrawing for the first part of a dopamine holiday. But it's that middle ground where most of our activities lie, where it really depends on how often your spikes of dopamine are coming, mm-hmm. right? Like you were saying, if you're having these pleasurable, quick-fix spikes over and over and over, they start to get less enjoyable, less rewarding, less motivating. And there's even a risk of it becoming that baseline that needs to be met, or else you feel crummy.
Right. Yeah, I think sometimes when we see depression in clients, what we're seeing is that. We're seeing yeah. people who have blitzed their dopamine receptors to the point where life doesn't seem very interesting anymore. You know, this anhedonia is this symptom that mm-hmm. we have in depression. And I think oftentimes, especially nowadays, it can be attributed to this. And there are things that people don't realize spike your dopamine higher than some drugs. You know,
yeah.
video game playing is one of them, depending on the video game. You have these loot style of video games that have a gambling component, where the more you play, yeah. the more you can level up, you can get items, and there's some randomness, enough intermittent reinforcement to it that it can really make the rest of life seem stupid and uninteresting.
Yeah.
When you've got a World of Warcraft or a Destiny 2 or something like that that you're in constantly. And then, of course, I always love to mention TikTok because I just think mm-hmm. it's designed to hijack this system well.
Yeah, apps are getting good at hacking our nervous systems and reward pathways to really get in there and get sticky.
Yeah, you have these super physiological doses of entertainment and hyper palatable foods. We can talk about foods in a second too, kind of along the same lines, that you can yeah. become addicted to a behavior, to a food item. Pornography is another one, internet porn. Never in our lives as a human society have we had access to the kind of sexual imagery and variety of imagery, where as soon as you get bored with an image or a video, you can find a new one. Like, our psychosexual yeah. system did not evolve to handle that kind of stimuli.
I know. I'm glad I didn't grow up in a world with the internet and that running rampant, because right. I do worry about our nervous systems as a society. But it's interesting to look back at where all that comes from. Like, dopamine exists to propagate our species. Like, that currency of motivation and success is because it drives us to survive as a species. Like, we seek food to survive. Food gives us a dopamine spike, so we seek more of it. If we're just eating repeatedly, those spikes become meaningless eventually mm-hmm. because they're too frequent, which also makes sense. But sex, to propagate the species, to have your DNA not cease to exist, we're driven by dopamine, and that's why sex is one activity that will triple your dopamine,
right.
like instantly.
Well, and it's one of the few that have a lot of those other neurotransmitters spiking too. Like, you had, depending on where you are during the sexual experience and response cycle, you've got a lot of oxytocin on board too.
Yeah.
And that's quite a cocktail of neurochemicals when you've got dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin all spiking at various times.
Sounds like MDMA.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess there's a reason why people do ecstasy and have orgies. You got a lot of fun in your neurochemical cocktail there.
Yeah, and you mentioned food. Mm-hmm. Look at something like chocolate. Doubles your dopamine, at least. Mm-hmm. But when you look at some of these external exogenous sources, like methamphetamine, mm-hmm. at a street user dose, can 10x your dopamine.
Yeah.
And wow. that becomes extremely habit-forming, like we see clinically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A couple of good books on dopamine. You have The Molecule of More.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the authors, but then you have the new one that just came out by Anna Lemke, Dopamine Nation.
Yeah.
Both authoritative sources on the things we're talking about, if you're interested in further reading.
Yeah, but to bring it back to that point of dopamine holidays, I like those a lot, both personally and for clients. Especially because I've prescribed hundreds and hundreds of stimulants over the years, mm-hmm. probably thousands, to be honest, having worked with a lot of ADHD and a lot of research settings, teen treatment center settings and all that. It's been interesting to watch the increase of stimulant prescriptions, like 20x in the past few decades.
Wow.
ADHD, in my short career so far, I've seen rates double or more, mm-hmm. 2.5. times increase, partially probably because of our distracted nation, partially because of recognition. And sure, some people do seek out that diagnosis and stimulant medications sometimes outside of the appropriate clinical uses, because maybe they're trying to hack the system or they're not taking care of their own sleep or things like that. But I think whether you're on stimulants or whether you're high on life from all these dopamine spikes, taking a dopamine holiday, being conscious of it, I think can be so therapeutic. And there are ways to do it that aren't so drastic or don't put you in such a funk.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awareness helps too. Like, if you're really paying attention to your indulgence in these dopaminergic activities or substances, I think you can manage it pretty well to where mm-hmm. your dopamine holidays don't have to be torture.
Yeah.
They don't have to be drudgery.
And for me, I've noticed that if you take some of those, what I'd call like healthy, positive ways of increasing dopamine, like going on a run or whatever the exercise is that you enjoy, or, you know, a good meal consisting of real good food mm-hmm. that's not a dramatic insulin spike and crash, mm-hmm. Then you're getting these spikes of dopamine that aren't either unrealistic peaks with a crash or, you know, TikTok likes in rapid succession mm-hmm. in a really habit-forming way. Then you can get through a dopamine funk or dopamine dysregulation syndrome window without much difficulty, if you just include some conscious dopamine.
Let me share a personal experience with what you're talking about for me. So yeah. I'm a gamer. I love video games. Have since I was a little kid. And there was a period of time as an adult where I was playing Destiny 2 was my video game of choice with friends almost every night. And I was a professional. right? Mm-hmm. And I'm staying up till 2 a.m. on a weeknight playing this video game because of it just had me hooked.
How old were you?
I was probably in my early 30s.
Okay, married and
married,
working.
Children, yeah. Yep, working. This is when I was in the Air Force. That one of my psychiatrist buddies would hop on and play with me at night. I mean, our clan consisted of mainly doctors. Like, mm-hmm. We were all grown-ass men playing these video games. And staying up way too late, being super tired. I already had a problem with sleep, but being tired all the time. And it got to a point where I was like, okay, this is kind of dysfunctional. My relationship to this video game is not super mm-hmm. functional. So I actually called my wife one day as I was falling asleep at the office, and I said, hide the game disc. Because when I get home, I don't want to play it. And if I ask you, like an addict, right? If I yeah. ask you where it is, don't tell me. So eventually I was able to break that habit, realized that, like, come to your senses, Steve. This game is not life and it's ruining yours. And so now I play video games once a week. And mm-hmm. I enjoy and look forward to that once a week video game playing way more than I enjoyed the yeah. daily drudgery, because it became almost like a job playing this game every night.
Yeah, that's a really, I think, a good example, because you can get so sucked into these things that keep you stuck with that little drip of dopamine, mm-hmm. and it's hard to extract yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, we have even residential treatment facilities now for video game addiction. So, and they all involve abstinence, right? They all involve a detox period, a holiday, so mm-hmm. that your brain can regrow those dopamine receptors, I guess.
Well, should we touch on hormones for a moment? I'm just thinking of other things to address early in the process of looking at, say, depression, dysthymia, mm-hmm. low mood, fatigue, chronic fatigue, perhaps. And what are some of the other areas of low-hanging fruit?
Yeah, I think one, especially for men, but also for women, that is low-hanging fruit that people don't often think about or look at is testosterone. This is one where, you know, I've heard from reputable sources that generally the testosterone levels in men have been decreasing over the last several decades, mm-hmm. where, you know, our reference range for an adult male is somewhere between 250 and 850 of free testosterone, not free, of total testosterone. Total. That's a huge reference range, by the way. Like the way you feel at 250 is much different than the way you feel at 850.
Night and day.
But you're finding a lot of dudes in their 30s who are hanging out in the 300s, and that's technically in the quote-unquote normal reference range, where, you know, you compare that to the average testosterone level of somebody in the 1950s, it would be hypogonadal to be in the 300s in your 30s. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing we would send people in when I was in the Air Force to get tested for, you know, get their blood levels checked. Because a lot of these military folks who had some head trauma from explosions or whatever scrambled their pituitary and their testosterone was in the crapper. And they'd get that treated through exogenous testosterone and their motivation improves, their sleep improves, their body composition changes, the way they hold on to fat changes, their sex drive improves, which improves their connection to their partner. It's a tide that lifts all the boats.
Yeah, I really, as a clinician, I really like it when I come across something that's so treatable, addressable. Mm. Because look at our depression treatment strategies in general. Like, the response rates aren't that great for an SSRI. It's not even a coin toss of whether or not someone will truly respond in a good way. Helpful for so many people, but they do leave so many people suffering. And when there's something that we encounter along the way, hopefully early on, because this is not hard to check, and I have people check it all the time, then great. You know, even though you might have to take a cream or even stick a needle in your butt 1, 2, 3 times a week, the gains from that, the rewards in terms of mood, energy, motivation, metabolic health even can be dramatic.
And I think it's important to do such a thing under the supervision of a medical professional.
Yeah.
You have a lot of people
crucial.
Yeah, doing sort of self-administered testosterone therapy. Because there's a lot of things that can go wonky, and it can take a while to really dial in your levels.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there are people who would use it for sort of at steroid levels. You're injecting a gram a test a week, mm-hmm. then you're doing it for bodybuilding purposes. But yeah, for health and longevity purposes, it's something to take a look at.
Yeah, it's one of those things that was harder to access before. I remember going through med school and then psychiatry training, really having an interest in this, but not feeling well equipped at the time to manage it. And I would, for years, refer to endocrinologists, and traditionally then they would almost require a really low testosterone level or something that would get that little star and an L by it on your lab report. Mm-hmm. I was seeing so many people still with symptoms that I felt to be related to a low testosterone, even when in that low normal range. So these days, it seems like awareness is spread, just like around our sleep patterns. Mm-hmm. And there are more and more holistic integrative clinics where you can go and get these things checked and get them addressed even earlier on.
Right. And there are natural ways to address your testosterone. By natural, yeah. I mean you don't necessarily have to take an exogenous hormone to improve your testosterone levels. But if you don't know it's low, then you don't know to treat it. So it's important to get tested. But there mm-hmm. are supplements you can take. And guess what, folks? If you exercise, especially if you lift weights, you sleep well, and you eat a nutritious diet, you can double your testosterone. The host of the Art of Manliness podcast, Brett McKay, he did an experiment where he got his testosterone checked. It was in like maybe the 300s. And he said, you know what, I'm going to do everything I possibly can based on the best science available to increase my testosterone, quote unquote, naturally. So he ate a high fat diet, high protein diet. He did powerlifting, prioritized sleep. And he was able to get his testosterone, I think, up into the high 700s.
Yeah, I was going to say you could probably double it from that level with lifestyle and nutritional and supplement interventions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not easily done, but those things have far-reaching benefits as well in life. So if you can use that as a carrot to dangle out in front of yourself, that's a great first pass at a low testosterone level.
Right. So other hormones like estrogen, prolactin, that's one that a lot of men don't take a look at is their prolactin levels. So, you know, prolactin is what signals the lactation in women, but mm-hmm. men also have prolactin. And if you have high prolactin, it can lead to sexual dysfunction, lead to impotence, low energy, low drive. And there's real straightforward ways of treating high prolactin. There's, you know, medicines you can take that shrink the cells that cause prolactin to be released. Some men will have, and not know it, have these prolactinomas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's what they're called, but there's, they're just growths or sometimes tumors on the, is it the pituitary? This is where I'm a psychologist.
Yeah,
folks.
Like
I'm
a pituitary adenoma.
Yeah, there mm-hmm. you go. And sometimes require surgery, but they can affect your prolactin levels.
And we will give a low dose of certain thyroid hormones to treat depression, even in the absence of a low or a hypothyroidism situation,
mm-hmm.
Which is interesting. I mean, we can intervene with some of these things, like the testosterone example, before things are even abnormal and get some really good results.
Yeah, yeah.
And one last thing about the testosterone. And I don't remember where it comes from. I think Huberman repeats it, but cites some other researcher, is that testosterone makes effort enjoyable.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great way of looking at it. Like we were talking about dopamine. What does that do? And testosterone, if it makes effort enjoyable, think about what that can do to your life in terms of getting back on the horse and doing a fitness exercise walking routine, or even in day-to-day life, putting in the work at your job, in your yard, in your marriage, things
exactly.
like that.
Yeah, I had a client once describe their depression to me as they were reluctantly participating in their own life.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a person who was fairly functional. You know, you might not know they have depression if you were their friend or their family member, but behind their eyes was a lot of, they had to force themselves to get out of bed, force themselves to go to work, just reluctantly participating. So the testosterone at the appropriate healthy level can make effort feel good. Makes a lot of sense that it could help mm-hmm. if you were depressed.
And then while we're on the depression topic, it reminds me, you mentioned light for sleep, but light is an intervention we'll often recommend or prescribe for depression.
Yeah.
You know, light therapy, blue light therapy. I even did a clinical trial or two on it back in the day when I was at the University of Utah, looking at specific blue light devices in the morning for a certain number of minutes for mood.
Especially during the winter months. Like if you live in a place in the world where during the winter it gets very dark all the time. I remember going to work when it was dark and leaving the office when it was dark. And at the time I didn't have a window in my office, so basically never saw the sun during the week. And those were rough weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And to further complicate it, your vitamin D level is probably decreasing. And vitamin D happens to be really important to neurotransmitter development and the building blocks of neurotransmitters. So that's one of the labs that I like to check in everyone and personally and monitor, because especially in the winter, I found mine can creep down into the 20s. But I really see you've got to aim for a vitamin D level of 50 to 75, let's say, to really optimize that neurotransmitter machinery.
And I think most of us are chronically low in vitamin D. In fact, I've been supplementing vitamin D for years, and I went to my annual checkup at my doctor, and she was like, "Oh, your vitamin D is normal." She was surprised that I had normal vitamin D because she sees low vitamin D in everybody.
Yeah.
So it's something that, especially nowadays that we spend so much time inside, that everyone should, I mean, I'm not your physician, but you should talk to your doctor about supplementing with vitamin D.
Yeah. And just as a reminder, back to Nutrition 101 is that vitamin D is one of the fat-soluble vitamins.
Right.
ADEC was the acronym I got in school to remember them, but vitamin A, D, E, and K. Which means that you can't take it in infinite quantities without consequences like you could something like vitamin C, that you just pee out. Vitamin D, while important to correct, you also need to correct it with the right dose.
Right. And would it be fair to say maybe if you want to increase absorption to take it with fat, does that help?
That's a good question. And
I wonder about that. The fish oil that I take, it has vitamin D combined. So it's a omega-3 fatty acid fish oil with vitamin D.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that of what the absorption looks like, but it's a really fair question, because vitamin mineral absorption is highly variable depending on what that vitamin or micronutrient is chelated with, like we were talking about the mag citrates versus threonates and all that, and how some can cross the blood-brain barrier, some get absorbed better in the gut. And the same is true with a lot of things and food, including some of the meds we prescribe.
Right. Let's talk about food for a minute. Talk about nutrition. So one of my favorite books about food is a book by a guy named Rob Wolf called Wired to Eat. So Rob was sort of made famous in the paleo world. He wrote the Paleo Solution, I think, before he came out with this. He's evolved his opinions about nutrition over the years. But the reason I like Wired to Eat is, and this is me, I'm not a nutrition expert. This is just, I've done a lot of research, both personally and for my clients, about the way food affects their physical and mental health, is that not all of us should be eating the same kind of diet. Not all of us should be eating the same kinds of foods. That because of whatever our genetic heritage might be, our ancestors might have evolved in an area of the world where certain food types were abundant and others were scarce, and so we got used to those types of foods. As an example, he and his wife, different genetic heritages, and so they installed CGMs, continuous glucose monitors, on their arms, and they would track their insulin and blood sugar responses to food, and they'd do these little experiments where one of them they both eat a cup of cooked white rice. And for Rob, his blood sugar would go through the roof. And for his wife, Nikki, it barely a blip on the radar. So it might make sense for his energy modulation and nutrition to be a little cautious about, you know, carb-rich foods if he's trying not to have blood sugar spikes, whereas maybe she's free to eat more rice. So I like the idea that eat whole, healthy foods. Try to avoid processed bullcrap, high sugar, hyperpalatable stuff. And then also don't be too rigid, you know, have some flexibility and eat mindfully, follow your hunger cues. But be considerate of other people who might be eating different types of food than you are, because maybe their bodies are wired better for those than yours.
Oh, yeah. Did you ever read any of Michael Pollan's books on food?
No.
Like In Defense of Food, for example? This is back in the day, pre-psychedelic books, but I think it's fitting that he's the one who wrote these best-selling psychedelic narratives, two of them now, and a number of pivotal articles, but because he wrote these books years ago that had this message of eat real food, mostly plants, and not too much. Mm. Yeah. And it is, I think this whole topic, just to tie it into psychedelic therapy for a sec, is so important because, like when you're preparing for an ayahuasca ceremony as an example, there's dietary prep, there's psychological prep, there's spiritual prep, there's physical prep. And that's part of the magic of the medicine, where the medicine itself is pretty magic. But taking the time and space for weeks before and weeks after to prepare, I think is so beneficial. And this focus in psychedelic therapy, whether it's with ketamine or psilocybin or MDMA, on integration really to me means focus on the day-to-day things that we're doing that support your wellness journey, like food, sleep, exercise, spiritual practices, and all that.
Yeah, the day-to-day things. You are what you rehearse. You are what you repeat. You are what you build, right? Steadily, slowly, repetitive over time.
Yeah, so you like the paleo approach. Is that how you approach nutrition currently? Or
that's how I do it personally. Yeah, mm-hmm. I try to eat whole foods, try to limit my processed food, and I just find that I do better on a lower carbohydrate, higher protein, higher fat diet. I've tried a full ketogenic diet before, mm-hmm. felt okay on it. My body odor increased significantly when I was in ketosis. People talk about keto breath or whatever, but I my BO got bad. It's also hard to stick to because
it is.
I mean, my energy levels were more even, but I love carbs. I love bread.
I got curious about ketosis. I don't know if it was 8 or 10 years ago. I was working with a lot of kids with neurodevelopmental disabilities, seizures, genetic conditions, and a ketogenic diet was a pretty evidence-based intervention for certain seizure disorders.
Yeah.
And then it became some of the other benefits became clear in terms of both weight loss, fat burning, mm-hmm. and kind of during strength training and performance optimization, but also for mental clarity. So I started experimenting with it back then with a nutrition coach. He was someone who would see the BYU football players, for example, mm-hmm. and he would point out to me that, okay, you're going into this place. He called it outer darkness because it was so difficult to get there. And he's like, you need to have some almond butter with you at all times, because when you come unhinged, you're going to come unhinged. There's mm-hmm. this primal hunger that might come out and send you on a binge. So he was trying to prepare me for it. It was really interesting because you get in ketosis, and I'd be measuring it with the urine dipsticks at the time.
Right.
And I'd get in that spot. It'd be so hard. I'd go through this mental fog. I'd get there and I'm like, it's like bliss. You're firing on all cylinders, like feel embodied, tuned in, dialed in. But then like one birthday party piece of cake and your ketosis castle crumbles.
Right.
But I'm back kind of playing around with that now with a breath monitor mm-hmm. from Biosense and approaching it more in a kind of gentle way, like going in instead of this strict 50 grams of carbs or less per day. More of the 1 to 200 grams a day range as more of a sustainable one to see how it feels swimming along that spectrum.
That's about where I am, between probably 1 and 300 grams of carbs. And I think that's easier to swim in that spectrum when your carb source is vegetables, potatoes, like sweet potatoes or whatever, and it's not an entire box of Girl Scout cookies, which I've done before.
Yeah, that brings up another point. I remember we like Jordan Peterson around mm-hmm. here, right? He has some really kind of wise and sometimes controversial, thought-provoking ideas and talks and books. And I remember one day my and I'm going to bring TikTok back in here.
Yeah.
My teenage daughter, who's currently in high school, is a couple years ago maybe, she said, "Have you seen this video?" And she shows me a TikTok, and it was Jordan Peterson talking about, if you want to reduce your anxiety in like half, you need to start your day with a high-protein, high-fat, low-carb meal. Hmm. And I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like that. And she said, "This sounds pretty cool. Is it true?" And so I got to thinking about it and even like reviewing some of the literature. And I do think there's something to it, both like personally, anecdotally, but also when you look at the science or the mechanisms around, you know, you wake up, you're in this partial low ketotic state, mm-hmm. like low level of ketosis. And I've used this breath meter to even measure myself and my kids mm-hmm. when not trying, but just after going, say, 10 to 12 hours without eating. You're in a mild state of ketosis, which is nice because it doesn't have, well, it's a good state. You're burning fat as fuel. If you don't need to tap into deep, deep reserves of carbs for a marathon, then that's a nice place to be. So when you eat, which you need to eat, you need to fuel your day. If you eat a bunch of simple carbs, you're going to get an insulin spike and some ghrelin release that's going to make you hungry right after. But the insulin spike, it's like now all of a sudden, the insulin workers are like factory workers on this assembly line, and the assembly line is your bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
And there's glucose going down it. They're taking the glucose, put it on shelves in your fat cells, your muscles, and then comes like hunger again in this repetitive cycle of this like simple sugar spike and crash versus, you know, protein and fat providing more of a energetic fuel for your day.
Yeah. When I'm in ketosis, or at least I'm eating a lower carbohydrate diet, my hunger cravings are less intense typically, and my energy levels are more even. One thing I've started doing is timing my carbohydrates in the evening, so they'll help me. So it'll help me sleep. So if I'm going to experience kind of that insulin spike and crash afterward, I want the crash to be when I'm ready to go to bed or in the evening.
Yeah.
So I try to eat most of my protein and fat for my morning and afternoon meals.
There's also some evidence that protein is used more efficiently in terms of muscle building blocks earlier right. in the day. But it's an interesting point about timing at night, because there's one dietary approach to Alzheimer's prevention that I like. I forget the author, but the book's called The End of Alzheimer's.
Mm.
And he talks about this ideal Alzheimer's prevention diet, in his opinion, is this flexitarian, light keto, 12/3 diet, meaning you have 12 hours a day to eat, 12 hours to sleep and get ready for sleep.
Hmm.
And the 3 hours is just a reminder not to eat 3 hours, to stop eating 3 hours before you sleep. For this this kind of optimal window of, preventing neuroinflammation, for example.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I've been doing. I'll eat dinner, and then I'll try not to eat anything after dinner.
Yeah.
One thing we should probably talk about, since you and I both work with people who have eating disorders,
yep.
is that whenever we're talking about strategies around nutrition, we need to be careful about rule making around mm-hmm. nutrition and shame making around
oh, yeah.
nutrition. And then, you know, one of the reasons I eat the way that I do and exercise the way that I do, one of the reasons is I care what I look like. I want to have a muscular physique. Not only because I want to have a strong body that is capable of doing the stuff I want to do, you know, playing with my kids, doing the athletic pursuits that I'm interested in, having great sex,
mm-hmm.
but I want to look good. So there's nothing, I'm saying that boldly, folks, because I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to look good. But it can obviously get out of hand
yeah,
to
yeah.
where like, oh crap, I went over my caloric limit today and I feel bad about myself. Or now I have to compensate. And there are violent ways to compensate, like forcing yourself to vomit, taking a diuretic, or there are less quote-unquote violent ways to compensate, like, well, I'm going to eat less tomorrow, or I'm going to go on an extra run.
Yeah.
So we need to be cautious about this, folks.
I'm glad you brought it up, because I could even feel the alarm bells ringing or some neurons standing on end in my body just saying, don't forget the disclaimers, because this is territory where I tread very lightly, and I'm of the one camp that'll say, don't track your calories, even though I have done it at times, mm-hmm. and it can be useful for me over a limited time window. But then I like to get back more into an intuitive approach. And I also tend to err on the side of, like, don't weigh your food. Mm-hmm. Because I've just had way too many clients, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, who have gotten into trouble with those practices in the eating disorder realm.
Right.
Although, like you pointed out, it's a very individual thing, and there are certainly people more at risk than others, and some people who can manage tracking or weighing in a very different way.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a fair comparison, but it came up in my mind. If you have a strong genetic predisposition to alcoholism, you might not want to try to become a social drinker.
Yeah.
So if you have if you have obsessive compulsive disorder and you have a lot of shame around your body image, legacy shame from a parent or something like that, and you don't feel good about yourself, you might not want to download MyFitnessPal. Like, you might not want to start tracking your calories. You might want to instead, if you're vulnerable to that kind of thing, focus on intuitive eating, acceptance of, you know, beauty at any size, like all that kind of stuff.
Because there is a subset of the population. There's a genetic predisposition to eating disorders that can put some people at high risk or at risk of getting stuck if they enter that dangerous place of food rules and, tracking and kind of rigidity around the whole process. In fact, there's a lot of data around what happens to the average American after they diet, mm-hmm. like fad diets, yo-yo diets, is that you lose some weight and then you regain it and then some,
right.
and the cycle repeats. But there's a subset of the population, whether it's a single digit percentage or something like that, where they diet and they enter almost a point of no return without help,
mm-hmm.
where the restricting continues and it starts going into places like anorexia.
Right. Yeah. So if you have a specific goal in mind that you're going to track your calories for a certain amount of time because your weight is at a place where it's unhealthy to be at that weight, and you need to a strategy and support to drop pounds to get mm-hmm. at a healthy weight. Like, there are reasons to track calories and there are reasons to weigh food, but enough said, probably. I think mm-hmm. you folks get the point.
Yeah, I remember when I was probably 19, I started experimenting with nutrition exercise pretty significantly in high school,
mm-hmm.
Got really interested. And it's fun to see my kids, my twin boys who are 12 right now, they're really getting into it. We've been going to VASA together.
Oh, cool.
And they're looking at, what does food do to fuel different movements and exercise? How does it make you feel? And what does it do to your body?
Mm-hmm.
I remember for a time, maybe around age 19, when I was vegan, and it started getting into places that felt, looking back on it now, bordering on orthorexia.
Yeah.
Just like when I started to not break my own food rules, or found myself even like judging what other people would eat, I had to take a big step back and just say, okay, what is the relationship with this in my life? And looking at it as a proxy for the relationship of, what does it mean for my life as a whole? Am I getting rigid in other ways, or judgmental in other ways? So I bring that up just as an example, because I think orthorexia is more and more of a concern, not an official diagnosis, but an unhealthy obsession with clean eating mm-hmm. that we see a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So maybe we could end on a short discussion about sort of our favorite ways of using physical fitness to improve our mental and spiritual health. I've dabbled in a lot of different approaches to fitness. You know, I was a high school football player that got me sort of obsessed with weightlifting. So I've done different kinds of weightlifting approaches, bodybuilding style, powerlifting style. I've played around with kettlebells with the Strong First model. I've done gymnastic strength training through the Gymnastics Bodies program. I've done CrossFit. That one ended in injury, unfortunately.
Sorry for your loss.
Thank you. And so I've meandered my journey through physical fitness to where I am today, which is I want to have a, like I was saying earlier, a strong, capable body that allows me to do the things I want to do pain-free. And I feel like that's going to carry me into my 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s with a higher quality of life. Like if I'm 80 years old and I can squat down and pick up a grandchild, I'll have lived a great life, right?
Yeah.
If my bone density is good and my muscle density is good because I've been lifting weights that whole time, then I think I will have made a good decision. So do something, folks, that you enjoy, something that you can do consistently because you enjoy it, and that will increase your quality of life. If you have a specific goal, like you're training for a marathon, do training appropriately for that. And then, you know, I've been forever fascinated by your practice with yoga because it's a great combination of physical fitness and a spiritual ethos, too.
Yeah, I think what you said about do something you enjoy is so key. Mm-hmm. Because we were talking about dopamine earlier. The runner's high really only applies if you like to run.
Right.
Like, and if you absolutely despise certain physical activity, it's going to give you less of a dopamine spike. So you do have to find that. I've used that as a personal hack in many ways where I know that I could get lost in a good game of racquetball, mm-hmm. for example, when I was in med school or college or on faculty somewhere. I could just go and get some really enjoyable cardio in that way and not even blink an eye compared to the treadmill that I might dread.
Right.
Or there have been times when, you know, in med school, I would bring my mountain bike with me every day because that was my natural Prozac. After long, long days taxing either rotations or study binges, I would have to go hop on the Shoreline Trail above the University of Utah at golden hour to get like a massive kind of brain reboot and little dopamine surge.
Yeah.
But yoga is one that I landed on, I guess in the last 7-8 years, that really spoke to me because I was on this meditation journey already, but it brought in this physical activity both as a carrot to get people to meditate, myself included, but also helped me learn embodiment in a new way, mm-hmm. like how to tune in and listen to my breath and let that inform how my nervous system is doing, and just such an efficient system of life that helped me plug into this embodied state, even a flow state, when I get into the right kind of practice, that has been crucial to me to the point where I don't let it slip. I will do, like, I've noticed that I need to be doing yoga at least a few times a week to keep my mental health intact or my mental wellness reserves in place.
As important as anything else that you do, right, is that exercise. Well, we might have to do a part two on this because this is something I love talking about, something I'm really, really interested in. Physical activity and fitness is how I get into flow state. It's how I keep myself sane. So remember, folks, you need to eat smart. You need to sleep well. You need to move more. We love you. Thanks for listening.
Take care.
Thank you, dear listener, for listening. It means a lot to me. Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Novamind, a mental health company that specializes in psychedelic medicine and research. You can learn more about Novamind's mission to increase access to legal, safe, and evidence-based psychedelic medicine at novamind.ca. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you're using to listen or watch. Also, if you're feeling generous today, please leave us a glowing review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you like to listen. If you'd like to reach out to us with questions, suggestions, scathing criticisms, etc., please email us at psychfrontiers@novamind.ca. Thanks again. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.